It wasn't hard to destroy Martian towns. No harder than breaking a window or popping a balloon. Nadya Chernyshevsky discovered this while holed up in the city offices of Laswitz, a tent town which had been punctured one night just after sunset. All the surviving occupants were now huddled in the city offices or the physical plant. For 3 days they had spent their time going out to try to repair the tent and watching TV to try and figure out what was going on. But the Terran news packages were concerned with its own wars, which seemed to be coalescing into one. Only infrequently was there a brief report on the wrecked Martian towns. One said that many domed craters had been hit by missiles from over the horizon, usually in a sequence where oxygen or aerated fuels were introduced and then quickly followed by an igniter that caused explosions of varying severity, from anti-personnel fires to blasts that blew the domes off to really big explosions that in effect re-excavated the crater. Anti-personnel oxygen fires appeared to be the most common. These left the infrastructure intact, for the most part. Tent towns were simpler still. Most of them had been punctured by Phobos-based lasers. Some had had their physical plants targeted by guided cruise missiles. Others had been invaded by troops of one kind or another, their spaceports seized, armored rovers crashing through city walls, and in rare cases, rocket-pack paratroopers descending from above. Nadya watched the jiggling video images that so clearly revealed the fear of the camera operators, her stomach collapsing to a tight walnut inside her. "What are they doing? Testing methods?" she cried.
"I doubt it," said Yelly Zudith.
"It's probably just a matter of different groups using different methods. Some look like they're trying to do as little damage as possible. Others seem to want to kill as many of us as they can, make more room for emigration." Nadya turned away, sickened. She got up and took off for the kitchen, bent slightly over her collapsed stomach, desperate to do something. In the kitchen, they had turned on a generator and were microwaving frozen dinners. She helped hand them out, moving up and down a line of people sitting in the hall outside. Unwashed faces, splashed with black frostnip blisters. Some people talked animatedly, others sat like statues or slept leaning against each other. Most of them had been residents of Laswitz, but a good number had driven in from tents or hideouts that had been destroyed from space or attacked by ground forces.
"Is stupid,"
an old Arab woman was saying to a gnarled little man.
"My parents were Red Crescent in Baghdad when the Americans bombed it. If they have the sky, is nothing you can do, nothing. We have to surrender, surrender as soon as possible."
"But to whom?" the little man asked wearily.
"And for whom? And how?"
"To anyone. From everybody. And by radio, of course."
The woman glared at Nadya, who shrugged. Then her wrist pad beeped, and Sasha Yefremov babbled in a tinny wrist phone voice. The water station north of town had gone up in an explosion, and the well it had capped was now fountaining in an artesian eruption of water and ice.
"I'll be right there," Nadya said, shocked.
The town's water station tapped the lower end of the Laswitz aquifer, which was a big one. If any significant part of the aquifer broached the surface, the water station and the town and the entire canyon they lay in would disappear in a catastrophic flood. And worse, Burroughs was located only 200 kilometers down the slope of Syrtis and Isidus, and the flood could very conceivably run that far. Burroughs. Its population was far too large to evacuate, especially now that it had become a refuge for people escaping the war. There was simply no other place to go.
"Surrender," the Arab woman insisted from the hall. "All surrender."
"I don't think that will work anymore," Nadya said, and ran for the building's lock.
A part of her was immensely relieved to be able to do something, to stop huddling in a building watching disasters on TV, and do something. And Nadya had platted and overseen the construction of Laswitz only 6 years before, so now she had an idea what to do. The town was a Nicosia-class tent, with the farm and physical plant in separate structures, and the water station well off to the north. All the structures were down on the floor of a big east-west rift called Arena Canyon, the walls of which were nearly vertical and half a kilometer high. The water station was located only a couple hundred meters from the canyon's north wall, which in that area had an impressive overhang at the top. As Nadia drove with Sasha and Yelly to the water station, she quickly outlined her plan.
"I think we can bring down the cliff onto the station, and if we can, the landslide ought to be enough to cap the leak."
"Won't the flood just carry the landslide's rock away?" Sasha asked.
"It will if it's a full aquifer outbreak, sure. But if we cover it when it's still just an uncapped well, then the escaping water will freeze in the landslide and hopefully form a dam heavy enough to hold it. Hydrostatic pressure in this aquifer is only a bit greater than the lithostatic pressure of the rock over it, so the artesian flow isn't all that high. If it were, we'd be dead already."
She braked the rover. Out the windshield, they could see the remains of the water station under a cloud of thin frost steam. A rover came bouncing full speed toward them, and Nadia flashed their headlights and turned the radio to the common band. It was the water station crew, a couple named Angela and Sam, rabid with the adventures of the last hour. When they had driven alongside and finished their story, Nadia explained to them what she had in mind.
"It could work," Angela said. "Certainly nothing else will stop it now. It's really pumping."
"We'll have to hurry," Sam said. "It's eating the rock at an unbelievable rate."
"If we don't cap it," Angela said with a certain morbid enthusiasm, "it'll look like when the Atlantic first broke through the Straits of Gibraltar and flooded the Mediterranean basin. That was a waterfall that lasted 10,000 years.
"I never heard of that one," Nadia said. "Come on with us to the cliff and help us get the robots going."
During the ride over, she had directed all the town's construction robots from their hangar to the foot of the north wall next to the water station. When the two rovers got there, they found a few of the faster robots had already arrived, and the rest were grinding over the canyon floor toward them. There was a small, talus slope at the foot of the cliff, which towered over them like an enormous frozen wave gleaming in the noon light. Nadia linked into the earth movers and bulldozers and gave them instructions to clear paths through the talus. When that was done, tunnelers would bore straight into the cliff. "See," Nadia said, pointing at an areological map of the canyon that she had called onto the rover's screen. "There's a big fault there behind that whole overhanging piece. It's causing the lip of the wall to slump a bit. See that slightly lower shelf at the top? If we set off all the explosives we've got at the bottom of that fault, it's sure to bring down the overhang, don't you think?"
"I don't know," Yelly said. "It's worth a try."
The slower robots arrived, bringing an array of explosives left over from the excavation of the town's foundation. Nadia went to work programming the vehicles to tunnel into the bottom of the cliff, and for most of an hour she was lost to the world. When she was finished, she said,
"Let's get back to town and get everyone evacuated. I can't be sure how much of the cliff might come down, and we don't want to bury everyone. We've got 4 hours.
"Jesus, Nadia."
4 hours.
She typed in the last command and started up their rover. Angela and Sam followed with a cheer.
"You don't seem very sorry to leave," Yelly said to them.
"Hell, it was boring," Angela said.
"I don't think that's going to be much of a problem anymore."
The evacuation was difficult. A lot of the town's occupants didn't want to leave, and there was barely room for them in the rovers at hand. Finally, they were all stuffed into one vehicle or another and off on the transponder road to Burrows. Laswitz was empty. Nadia spent an hour trying to contact Phyllis by satellite phone, but the comm channels were disrupted by what sounded like a number of different jamming efforts. Nadia left a message on the satellite itself.
"We're non-combatants in Syrtis Major trying to stop the Laswitz aquifer from flooding Burrows, so leave us alone."
A surrender of sorts.
Nadia and Sasha and Yelly were joined in their rover by Angela and Sam, and they drove up the steep switchbacks of the cliff road onto the south rim of Arena Canyon. Across from them was the imposing north wall. Below to the left lay the town, looking almost normal, but to the right it was clear something was wrong. The water station was broken in the middle by a thick white geyser which plumed like a broken fire hydrant and then fell into a jumble of dirty red-white ice blocks. This weird mass shifted even as they watched, briefly exposing black flowing water which frost-steamed madly, white mists pouring out of the black cracks and then whipping down canyon on the wind. The rock and fines of the Martian surface were so dehydrated that when water splashed onto them, they seemed to explode in violent chemical reactions, so when the water ran over dry ground, great clouds of dust fired off into the air and joined the frost steam swirling off the water.
Sax will be pleased, Nadia said grimly.
At the appointed hour, four plumes of smoke shot out of the base of the northern wall. For several seconds, nothing else happened, and the observers groaned. Then the cliff face jerked, and the rock of the overhang slipped down, slowly and majestically. Thick clouds of smoke shot up from the bottom of the cliff, and then sheets of ejecta shot out like water from under a calving iceberg. A low roar shook their rover, and Nadia cautiously backed it away from the south rim. Just before a massive cloud of dust cut off their view, they saw the water station covered by the swift, tumbling edge of the landslide. Angela and Sam had been cheering. "How will we tell if it's worked?" Sasha asked. "Wait till we can see it again," Nadia said. "Hopefully the flood downstream will have gone white. No more open water, no more movement." Sasha nodded. They sat looking down into the ancient canyon, waiting. Nadia's mind was mostly blank. The thoughts that did occur to her were bleak. She needed more action like the last few hours, the kind of intense activity that gave her no time to think. Even a moment's pause and the whole miserable situation crashed back in on her. The wrecked cities, the dead everywhere, Arkady's disappearance. And no one in control, apparently. No plan to any of it. Police troops were wrecking towns to stop the rebellion, and rebels were wrecking towns to keep the rebellion alive. It would end with everything destroyed, her whole life's work blown up before her eyes, and for no reason. No reason at all. She couldn't afford to think. Down there, a landslide had overrun a water station, hopefully, and the water rushing up the well had been blocked and frozen, making a composite dam. After that, it was hard to say. If the hydrostatic pressure in the aquifer was high enough, a new breakout might be forced. But if the dam were thick enough, well, nothing to be done about it. Although if they could create some kind of escape valve to take the pressure off the landslide dam... Slowly the wind tattered the dust away. Her companions cheered. The water station was gone, covered by a fresh black landslide that spilled out from the northern wall, which now had a big new arc in its rim. But it had been a close thing. Not anywhere near as big a landslide as she would have hoped. Laswitz itself was still there, and it appeared that the layer of rock over the water station was not all that thick. The flood seemed to have stopped, it was true. It was motionless, a chunky, dirty white swath like a glacier running down the middle of the canyon, and there was very little frost steam rising from it. Still... "Let's go back down to Laswitz and look at the aquifer monitors," Nadia said. They drove back down the canyon wall road and into Laswitz's garage. They walked down the empty streets in walkers and helmets. The Aquifer Study Center was located next to the city offices. It was odd to see their refuge of the last few days empty. Inside the Aquifer Center, they studied the readouts from the array of underground sensors. A lot of them were no longer functioning. But those that were showed that hydrostatic pressure inside the aquifer was higher than ever before, and increasing. As if to emphasize the point, a small trembler shook the ground, vibrating the soles of their boots. None of them had ever felt such a thing on Mars before. "Shit," Yelly said. "It's going to blow again, for sure." We have to drill a runoff well, Nadia said. A kind of pressure valve.
But what if it breaks out like the main one? Sasha asked.
If we put it at the upper end of the aquifer or midway so that it takes some flow, it should be fine. Just as good as the old water station, which someone probably blew up, or else it would still be working fine. She shook her head bitterly. We have to risk it. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, then maybe we cause an outbreak. But if we don't do something, it looks like there'll be an outbreak anyway.
She led the little group down the main street to the robot warehouse in the garage and sat down in the command center to begin programming again. A standard drilling operation with maximum blowout baffling. The water would come to the surface under artesian pressure, and then they would direct it into a pipeline which they would instruct a robot crew to lay in some direction that would take it out of the Arena Canyon region. She and the others studied topographic maps and ran simulated floods down several canyons paralleling Arena to north and south. They found that the watershed was huge. Everything on Syrtis drained down toward Burrows. The land was a big bowl here. They would have to pipe the water north for nearly 300 kilometers to get it into the next watershed.
Look, Yelly said. Released into the Nylai Fosse, it will run straight north onto Utopia Planitia and freeze on the northern dunes.
Sax must be loving this revolution, Nadia said again. He's getting stuff they never would have approved.
But a lot of his projects must be getting wrecked, too, Yelly pointed out.
I bet it's still a net gain, in Sax's terms. All this water on the surface.
We'll have to ask him.
If we ever see him again.
Yelly was silent. Then he said,
Is it that much water, really?
It's not just Laswitz, Sam said. I saw a news bit a while ago. They've broken the Lowell Aquifer, a big breakout like the ones that cut the outflow channels. It'll rip billions of kilos of regolith downslope, and I don't know how much water. It's unbelievable.
But why? Nadia said.
It's the best weapon they have, I guess.
Not much of a weapon. They can't aim it or stop it.
No, but neither can anyone else. And think about it. All the towns downslope from Lowell are gone. Franklin, Drexler, Osaka, Galileo, I imagine even Silverton. And all those were transnational towns. A lot of channel mining towns are vulnerable, I should think.
So both sides are attacking the infrastructure, Nadia said dully.
That's right.
She had to work. There was no other choice. She got them going again on robot programming, and they spent the rest of that day and the next getting the robot teams out to the drilling site and making sure the startup went right. The drilling was straightforward. It was only a matter of making sure that pressures in the aquifer didn't cause a blowout, and the pipeline to transfer the water north was even simpler, an operation that had been fully automated for years. But they doubled up on all the equipment just to make sure. Up the North Canyon roadbed and on northward from there. No need to include pumps. Artesian pressure would regulate the flow quite nicely, because when the pressure dropped low enough to stop pushing water out of the canyon, the danger of a breakout at the lower end would presumably be past. So when the mobile magnesium mills were grinding along, scooping up fines and making pipe, and when the forklifts and front loaders were taking these pipe segments to the assembler, and when that great moving building was taking in the segments and extruding pipe behind it as it rolled slowly along up the road, and when another mobile behemoth was going over the completed pipe and wrapping it in aerolattice insulation made from tailings from the refinery, and when the first segment of the pipeline was heated and running, then they declared the system operational and hoped it would make it 300 kilometers farther. The pipeline would be built at about a kilometer an hour for 24 and a half hours a day. So if all went well, about 12 days to Nylai Fosse. At that rate, the pipeline would be done very soon after the well was drilled and ready. And if the landslide dam held that long, then they would have their pressure valve. So Burrows was safe, or as safe as they could make it by their efforts. They could go, but it was a question what their destination should be.
Nadia sat slumped over a microwave dinner, watching a Terran news show, listening to her companions debate the issue. Horrible how the revolution was being portrayed on Earth. Extremists, communists, vandals, saboteurs, reds, terrorists. Never the words rebel or revolutionary, words of which half the Earth, at least, might approve. No, they were isolated groups of insane, destructive terrorists. And it didn't help Nadia's mood that there was, she felt, some truth to the description. It only made her angrier.
"We should join whoever we can and help fight," Angela said.
"I'm not fighting anyone," Nadia said mulishly. "It's stupid. I won't do it. I'll fix things where I can, but I won't fight."
A message came over the radio. Fournier Crater, about 860 kilometers away, had a cracked dome. The populace was trapped in sealed buildings and running out of air.
"I want to go there," Nadia said. "There's a big central warehouse of construction robots there. They could fix the dome and then be set to other repairs down on Isidus."
"How will you get there?" Sam asked. Nadia thought it over, took a deep breath.
"Ultralight, I guess. There's some of those new 16Ds up on the South Rim airstrip. That would be the fastest way for sure, and maybe even the safest, who knows?"
She looked at Yelly and Sasha.
"Will you fly with me?"
"Yes," Yelly said. Sasha nodded.
"We want to come with you," Angela said. "It'll be safer with two planes anyway."
They took two planes that had been built by Spencer's Aeronautic Factory in Elysium, the latest things, called simply 16Ds, ultralight, delta-winged, four-seat turbojets, made mostly of aerogel and plastics, dangerous to fly because they were so light. But Yelly was an expert flyer, and Angela said she was too, so they climbed into two of them the next morning, after spending the night in the empty little airport, and taxied out to the packed dirt runway and took off directly into the sun. It took them a long time to rise to 1,000 meters. The planet below looked deceptively normal, its old, harsh face only a bit whiter on the north faces, as if aged by its parasite infestation. But then they flew out over Arena Canyon and saw running down it a dirty glacier, a river of broken ice blocks. The glacier widened frequently where the flood had pooled for a time. The ice blocks were sometimes pure white, but more often stained one Martian shade or other, then broken and tumbled into a mix, so that the glacier was a shattered mosaic of frozen brick, sulfur, cinnamon, coal, cream, blood, spilling down the flatbed of the canyon all the way to the horizon, some 75 kilometers away. Nadia asked Yelly if they could fly north and inspect the land that the robots were going to build the pipeline over. Soon after they turned, they received a weak radio message on the first 100 band from Anne Claiborne and Simon Fraser. They were trapped in Peridier Crater, which had lost its dome. It was to the north also, so they were already on the right course. The land they crossed that morning appeared negotiable to the robot team. It was flat, and though littered with ejecta, there were no little stopper escarpments. Farther on in this region, the Nilae Fossae began, very gradually at first, just 4 very shallow depressions curving down to the northeast like the fingertips of a faint handprint. 100 kilometers farther north, however, and they were parallel chasms, each 500 meters deep, separated by dark land that had been heavily bashed by craters, a kind of lunar configuration, reminding Nadia of a messy construction site. Farther north still, they got a surprise. Where the easternmost canyon debouched onto Utopia, there was another aquifer outbreak. At its upper end, it was simply a new slump, a big bowl of land shattered like a broken plate of glass. Lower down, patches of frosting black and white water surged right out of the broken land, ripping at the new blocks and carrying them away even as they watched, in a steaming flood that caused the land it touched to explode. This shocking wound was at least 30 kilometers across and ran right over the horizon to the north with no sign of dissipating. Nadia stared at the sight and asked Yelly to fly nearer. "I want to avoid the steam," Yelly said, absorbed in the sight himself. Most of the white frost cloud was blowing east and falling down onto the landscape, but the wind was fitful, and sometimes the thin white veil would rise straight up, obscuring the swath of black water and white ice. The outflow was as big as one of the big Antarctic glaciers, or even bigger, cutting the red landscape in two.
"That is a hell of a lot of water," Angela said.
Nadia switched to the first 100 band and called Anne down in Perigier.
"Anne, do you know about this?" She described what they were flying over. "And it's still running. The ice is moving, and we can see patches of open water. It looks black, or sometimes red, you know?"
"Can you hear it?"
"Just sort of like a ventilator hum and some cracks and pops from the ice, yeah. But we're pretty loud up here ourselves. Hell of a lot of water."
"Well," Anne said, "that aquifer isn't very big compared to some."
"How are they breaking them open? Can people really break those open?"
"Some of them," Anne said. "The ones with hydrostatic pressure greater than lithostatic pressure are in essence lifting the rock up, and it's the permafrost layer that's forming a kind of dam, an ice dam. If you drilled a well and blew it up, or if you melted it..."
"But how?"
"Reactor meltdown." Angela whistled.
"But the radiation," Nadia cried.
"Sure, but have you looked at your counter lately? I figure 3 or 4 of them must have gone."
"Wow!"
Angela cried. "And that's just so far." Anne's voice had that distant dead tone it took on when she was angry. She answered their questions about the flood very briefly. A flood that big caused extreme pressure fluctuations. Bedrock was smashed, then plucked away, and it was all swept downstream in a pulverizing rush, a ripping, gaseous, boulder-filled slurry.
"Are you going to come over to Perigier?"
she asked when their questions trailed off.
"We're just turning east now," Yelly replied. "I want to get a visual fix on Crater FV first."
"Good idea."
They flew on. The astounding roil of the flood dropped beneath the horizon, and they flew over the familiar old stone and sand again. Soon Perigier appeared over the horizon ahead, a low, much-eroded crater wall. Its dome was gone, tattered sheets of the fabric thrown aside, still rolling this way and that over the crater rampart, as if a seed pod had burst. The piste running south reflected the sun like a silver thread. They flew over the arc of the crater wall, and Nadia peered down at the dark buildings through binoculars, cursing in a low Slavic chant.
How? Who? Why?
There was no way to tell. They flew on to the airstrip out on the far crater rampart. None of the hangars was working, and they had to suit up and drive some little cars over the rim into town. All the surviving occupants of Perigier were holed up in the physical plant. Nadia and Yelly went through its lock and gave Anne and Simon a hug, and then they were introduced to the others. There were about 40 of them, living off emergency supplies, struggling to balance the gas exchange in the sealed buildings.
"What happened?"
Angela asked them, and they told the story in a kind of Greek chorus, interrupting each other frequently. A single explosion had burst the dome like a balloon, causing an instantaneous decompression that had also blown up many of the town's buildings. Luckily, the physical plant was reinforced and had withstood the internal pressures of its own air supply, and those inside had survived. Those out on the streets or in the other buildings had not.
"Where's Peter?"
Yelly asked, startled and fearful.
"He's on Clark," Simon said quickly. "He called us right after this all began. He's been trying to get a spot on one of the elevators down, but it's all police at this point. I guess there are a lot of them in orbit. He'll get down when he can. It's safer up there right now anyway, so I'm not in that much of a hurry to see him."
This made Nadia think of Arkady again, but there was nothing to be done, and quickly she set herself to the task of rebuilding Perigier. She first asked the survivors what their plans were, and when they shrugged, she suggested that they start by setting up a much smaller tent than the dome had been, using tenting material stored in the construction warehouses out at the airport. There were a lot of older robots mothballed out there, and so reconstruction would be possible without too much preliminary tooling. The occupants were enthusiastic. They hadn't known about the contents of the airport warehouses. Nadia shook her head at this.
"It's all in the records," she said to Yelly later. "They only had to ask. They just weren't thinking. They were just watching the TV, watching and waiting."
"Well, it's a shock to have a dome go like that, Nadia. They had to make sure the building was secure first."
"I guess."
But there were very few engineers or construction specialists among them. They were mostly escarpment aerologists or miners. Basic construction was something that robots did, or so they seemed to think. It was hard to say how long they would have gone before they would have started in on the reconstruction themselves, but with Nadia there to point out what could be done and drive them with a brief burst of withering scorn at their inactivity, they were soon underway. Nadia worked 18 and 20 hours a day for a few days and got a foundation wall laid and tenting cranes into action over the rooftops. After that, it was mostly a matter of supervision. Restlessly, Nadia asked her companions from Laswitz if they would join her in the plains again. They agreed, and so about a week after their arrival, they took off again, with Anne and Simon joining them in Angela and Sam's plane. As they flew south, down the slope of Isidus toward Burrows, a coded message clittered abruptly over their radio speakers. Nadia dug through her pack and found a bag of stuff Arkady had given her, including a bunch of files. She found the one she wanted and plugged it into the plane's AI, and they ran the message through Arkady's decryption program. After a few seconds, the AI spoke the message in its even tones. "Unoma is in possession of Burrows and detaining everyone who comes here." There was silence in the two planes, winging south through the empty pink sky. Below them, the plain of Isidus sloped down to the left. Anne said, "Let's go there anyway. We can tell them in person to stop the assaults." "No," Nadia replied. "I want to be able to work, and if they lock us up... Besides, why do you think they'd listen to what we tell them about the assaults?" No answer from Anne. "Can we make it to Elysium?" Nadia asked Yelly. "Yes." So they turned east and ignored radio queries from Burrow's air traffic control. "They won't come after us," Yelly said with assurance. "Look, the satellite radar shows there's a lot of planes up and around, too many to go after all of them. And it would be a waste of time anyway, because I suspect most of them are decoys. Someone sent up a whole lot of drones, which confuses the issue nicely as far as we're concerned."
"Someone really put a lot of effort into this," Nadia muttered as she looked at the radar image. 5 or 6 objects were glowing in the southern quadrant. "Was it you, Arkady? Did you hide that much from me?" She thought of that radio transmitter of his, which she had just run across in her bag. "Or maybe it wasn't hidden. Maybe I just didn't want to see it."
They flew to Elysium and landed next to South Fossa, the largest roofed canyon of them all. They found that the roof was still there, but only, it turned out, because the city had been depressurized before it had been punctured. So the inhabitants were trapped in any number of intact buildings and trying to keep the farm alive. There had been an explosion at the physical plant and several others in the town itself. So there was a lot of work to be done, but there was a good base for a quick recovery and a more enterprising population than the group in Peridier. So Nadia threw herself into it as before, determined to fill every waking moment with work. She couldn't stand to be idle. She worked every moment she was awake, her old jazz tunes running through her mind, nothing appropriate. There was no jazz or blues appropriate to this. It was all completely incongruous. On the sunny side of the street, pennies from heaven, a kiss to build a dream on. And in those hectic days on Elysium, she began to realize just how much power the robots had. In all her years of construction, she had never really tried to exert that power to the full. There simply had been no need. But now there were hundreds of jobs to be done, more than could be accomplished even with a total effort, and so she took the system right out to the bleeding edge, as programmers would say, and saw just how much that effort could do, even as she tried to figure out how to do more. She had always considered teleoperation to be a basically local procedure, for instance, but it wasn't necessarily so. Using relay satellites, she could drive a bulldozer in the other hemisphere, and now, whenever she could establish a good link, she did so. She didn't stop working for even a single waking second. She worked as she ate. She read reports and programs in the bathroom, and she never slept except when exhaustion knocked her out. While in this timeless state, she told anyone and everyone she worked with what to do, without regard for their opinion or comfort. And in the face of her monomaniacal concentration and the authority of her grasp of the situation, people obeyed her. Despite all this effort, they couldn't do enough. It always came back to Nadia, and she alone, through the sleepless hours, gave the system a full stretch, out on the bleeding edge all the time. And Elysium had a huge fleet of construction robots already built, so that it was possible to attack most of the pressing problems simultaneously. Most of those were located among the canyons on Elysium's western slope. All the roofed canyons had been broken open to one degree or another, but most of their physical plants were untouched, and there were a great number of survivors hunkered down in individual buildings running on emergency generators, as in South Fossa. When South Fossa was covered and heated and pumped up, she directed teams to go out and find all the survivors on the western slope, and they were pulled out of the other canyons and brought to south, and then sent back out with jobs to do. The roofing crews moved from canyon to canyon, and their ex-occupants went to work underneath, readying for the pump-ups. At that point, Nadia turned her attention to other matters, programming toolmakers, starting robot linemen along the broken pipelines from Chasma Borealis.
"Who did all this?" she said with disgust, staring one night at the TV's image of burst water pipes.
The question was torn out of her. In reality, she didn't want to know. She didn't want to think about the bigger picture, about anything but that pipeline there, broken on the dunes. But Yelly took her at her word and said, "It's hard to tell. The Terran news programs are all about Earth now. There's only an occasional clip from here, and they don't know what to make of it either. Apparently, the next few shuttles are bringing UN troops who are supposed to restore order. But most of the news is about Earth, the Middle East war, the Black Sea, Africa, you name it. A lot of the Southern Club is bombing flag of convenience countries, and the Group of Seven has declared they're going to defend them. And there's a biological agent loose in Canada and Scandinavia. And maybe here, too," Sasha interrupted. "Did you see that clip of Acheron? Something happened there. The windows of the habitat are all blown out, and the land underneath the fin is covered with these growths of God knows what. No one wants to get near enough to find out." Nadia closed her mind to their talk and concentrated on the problem of the pipeline. When she returned to real time, she found that every single robot she could find was in action reconstituting the towns, and the factories were busily pumping out more bulldozers, earth movers, dump trucks, backhoes, front loaders, steamrollers, framers, foundation diggers, welders, cement makers, plastic makers, roofers, everything. The system was at full pump, and there wasn't enough to occupy her anymore. And so she told the others she wanted to take off again. And Anne and Simon and Yelly and Sasha decided to accompany her. Angela and Sam had met friends in South Fossa and were going to stay. So the five climbed into their two planes and took off again. This was the way it would happen everywhere, Yelly asserted. Whenever members of the First Hundred encountered each other, they wouldn't separate.